Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. I will shortly be joined by my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring, and today we will be looking at Robert Blatchford's book Merry England, and this is part three in our series on Robert Blatchford. Well, should we get into our Greatest Britons then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's talk about Robert Blatchford again with his amazing moustache. Last week we got into some quotes from Merry England, and we were looking at the factory system and how it had ruined the countryside. And this week we're going to take a look at how we could be using that land for farming instead. And we're quoting from page 28 here from his book, and he says, "We come now to the third objection to the factory system, that it is unnecessary. It is often asserted that this country could not feed all her present population. I will try to show you that this is absurd. We have to prove that the British Islands can grow wheat enough to feed 36 million people. In Hoyle's Sources of Wealth, it is stated that Great Britain and Ireland contain about 50 million acres of good land, unbuilt upon and available for agriculture. And Lord Lauderdale estimates that 500 acres will feed 2,000 people. That is 4 to the acre. Therefore, if we used all our available land, we could feed 200 million people." So that's about three times as much people as we actually have in Britain today. We could feed them with these acres of good land. Now I'm a bit concerned that did they mean forestry here? Was this just all open land that could be used for this, Max? What do you think of this? Is this a viable idea that he has here?
Well, when I first heard this idea, I was fascinated by it to a certain extent, and I decided just to investigate whether it was true. And one of the things that I have discovered since becoming vegetarian, basically, is that you can live on potatoes. And I think I've said that before. You can live entirely on potatoes, and the yield in good arable land of potatoes is such that, yes, it would be possible to feed 200 million people in the British Isles, if we all ate potatoes. I didn't repeat the exercise with regard to other foodstuffs because I just really wanted to prove whether or not it was possible to sustain 200 million people from the acreage of arable land available to farmers, both in this country and in Ireland. And we've got to bear in mind that that includes Southern Ireland as well. So in view of the fact that ERA has detached itself and is now part of the European Union, there's a fair bit of arable land there that would have been available to us in the early 1900s, which is no longer available to certainly the British government. But that won't necessarily always be the case, because it's my dream that the people of Southern Ireland will one day rejoin the British Isles, their sort of sister nations on the British Isles, and that we will have the four nations of the British Isles reunited under a common leadership. But that's something for the future. But certainly it would be possible to feed 200 million people. And the fact of the matter is that we, instead of feeding ourselves in that way, what we've done is we've just invested a lot of our time in concreting over a lot of the arable land that perhaps would have existed in 1900 to produce factories in order to try and become the workshop of the world. And so I doubt that we could feed 200 million people from the arable land that's available to the United Kingdom at the moment, but it probably would be in excess of 100 billion. And so, you know, we still are in a situation where we could achieve autarky. We could achieve a situation where we are able to provide everything that the people of these islands needs from within our own resources.
There's probably a lot of land up in Scotland that could be used. I would also be concerned that maybe land would have been used for housing purposes as well, to house all the excess peoples that have come to Britain, because as we've pointed out before, we're not producing enough people to replace ourselves already, so we shouldn't actually need any new housing. But I think they're using up some of this land for that as well, but there should be enough to amply feed the 70 million people that there are actually here if we just use the land properly. Well, continuing here, agriculture has been neglected because all the mechanical and chemical skill and all the capital and energy of man have been thrown into the struggle for trade profits and manufacturing preeminence. We want a few Faradays, Watts, Stevensons and Cobdens to devote their genius and industry to the great food question. Once let the public interest and the public genius be concentrated upon the agriculture of England, and we shall soon get silenced, the croakers who talk about the impossibility of the country feeding her people. Depend upon it, what I have told you is true, and that England can feed her people as she had fed them in times gone by, with never a factory flue to vomit foulness into the air, and never a greedy money grasper to poison her streams with filth, or wither her woods and glades with soot and sulphur. And I do think that today, when they build factories, they do try to beautify the area as well, and have some countryside programs to help the countryside at the same time as putting the factories up. And you do get factories now that are actually being built in the countryside to try and balance things out, so they aren't all there in the city. And I think he's makes a good point here about the fact that we need these geniuses, Faradays, Watts, Stevensons and Cobdens. It's genius, it's individual genius that spurs us on forwards. It's not committees, it's not groups of people, it's individual geniuses. And you don't get individual geniuses in peoples that have average IQs of under 100. You're just not going to get it. You're not going to get people with a genius IQ of 130, 140, up to, I don't know, 160. You're just not going to get that with the sort of people that we are now importing into our country. So it's good here that he understands that it's just these individuals that we have in our nation, that they're the ones that actually push us forwards, and he wants to see their genius devoted to food. And where he's also pointing out here about mechanical and chemical skill, I mean, the chemical skill has been applied to food, and that hasn't been too good. I mean, I don't like the idea of the genetic modification of organisms, and obviously buying organic is much better, and organic provides work for people as well, with the physical work that is involved in producing the food. It is much better for you, but the problem is that it costs more, and people have got to pay more for it. So I guess you've got to weigh both of those things up. But there have been a lot of advances with farm engineering and farm mechanics since this time. I do think they have actually put more thought into this since then, Max. I get the impression that that they've had to, really. There's been a lot of pressure on the government to clean the country up, beautify the country, not have so much pollution in the cities, because they used to have this pea super fog in London, and it used to be, you know, you didn't used to be able to even see your hand in front of your face. It was so polluted, you know, sort of the way that we sometimes see Hong Kong or some of the places in China. That's what Britain used to be like. So I do think there has been some improvements, but possibly not enough. What are your thoughts on what he says here about agriculture, Max?
Yeah, I think there have been some improvements. The there are regulations now that apply to issues that affect the environment, and I think that air is generally cleaner today than it has been in the past. You know, there's still some focus on the quality of air in large towns and cities, you know, particularly central London. But if you come out to the rural parts of Britain, there's lots of lovely fresh air here. And the Town Planning Acts that prevented the unrestrained building over of arable land did serve a great purpose. And I mentioned, I think last week, the garden cities and things that had been created during the early part of the last century. And so there has been a lot of work done in order to prevent the spoiling of our countryside and to improve the environment generally. And I think that even as far as farming is concerned, there, despite the fact there's been a lot of automation, which has tended to make farms very large and it's destroyed hedgerows and things of that sort, which people don't like, there has been other forms of automation, particularly in the dairy industry, where there are now milking sheds and things that are not just crude sheds, that are very highly sophisticated places that are very clean, and where cattle are, the nutrients that they receive are exactly what they need in order to maximise output, and they are milked in very sterile and clean and sterile sort of circumstances, and that has improved milk yields and things of that sort. And so I think that there is some work to be done. There hasn't been a concerted effort to do it, though, in the same way that as we've seen with coronavirus, there was a tremendous amount of work done that was sponsored by the government, that was done at Oxford University in order to push forward and to find a vaccine. And if you just think back to other occasions when there has been a vital national necessity that we have a centre of excellence, where people of high intelligence, people who are able to think outside the box, are taken just purely because of their ability to think outside the box, their ability to innovate. So during the Second World War, we had Bletchley Park, where lots and lots of young people that were very intelligent were sent there with a blank sheet of paper. They could to design ways of cracking the codes, etc., that existed, that the Germans used during the Second World War, and where they fed off each other in terms of the ideas that they were looking at, in order to make the tremendous advances that they did, and in order to invent the computer and tremendous benefits have come as a result of the invention of the computer, and then with regard to the sort of the race to produce atomic weapons at the end of the Second World War with the Manhattan Project, so there are occasions when governments do see that the overriding need to make a step change or a step forward, a large step forward in science in one particular area because of a pressing political need, has caused governments to create places of that sort, and what we need is a government to do the same thing with regard to agriculture and with regard to the task not just of producing profits from agriculture, but the task of feeding our population, and not just feeding them entirely on potatoes, but feeding them a varied diet that will make the food interesting and palatable.
Improving their lives and making them more healthy. I mean, you have to give them credit, really, over the last 100 years. You can see by the way that the average height has increased, that the nutrition has got better, and people weren't living to the fullness of their phenotype before, and that's why the houses were shorter and the door frames were smaller, because people's nutrition wasn't so good. So that has improved, and I think Britain is fairly proud of the way that we treat our animals. We do have very strict rules that have to be kept to. We do still have factory farming, but it's things like chickens that only have tiny little brains. You wouldn't see cattle being treated in that way, for instance. Well, we will next proceed to consider my fourth objection to the factory system, when I think I shall be able to show you beyond all question that besides being hideous, unpleasant, unhealthy and unnecessary, the factories are a serious danger to the existence of the empire. Why do we weave cloth and cotton? For two purposes. One, to clothe ourselves, and two, to exchange for foreign produce. To provide for our own needs, we must make cotton or linen fabrics, true, but we need not make them by steam power. We could make them by water power, and so abolish the smoke nuisance. Will you have the goodness, Mr. Smith, to cast your eyes over the following statements made a few years ago by a Professor Thompson? The average rise and fall of the tide at the city of Bristol, 5 miles from its mouth, is 23 feet. According to calculations I have made from the average volume of water displaced up and down each tide, there are no fewer than 20 billions of foot-pounds of energy wasted each year, or enough to charge 10 million Faro cells. At the mouth of the river, the total annual energy thus running to utter waste cannot be less than 60 billion foot-pounds, and in the rapid currents of the River Severn, with their enormous tides of great volume, the tidal energy must be practically unlimited. A tenth part of the tidal energy in the Gorge of the Avon would light the city of Bristol. A tenth part of the tidal energy in the Channel of the Severn would light every city. And another tenth part would turn every loom and spindle and axle in Great Britain. The power of water is tremendous. The beauty of water is sublime. Perhaps when our practical men learn a little common sense, we shall be able to grind an axe or throw a shuttle without blackening the sky above or choking the unhappy creatures who crawl upon the earth beneath. Besides, the less coal needed, the fewer colliers needed, and in the Clarion, Tito has told us that 90,000 men and boys are killed and injured every year in the mines. So he's basically advocating the use of natural resources here, much cleaner natural resources, and it it seems to me an extension of the water wheel that used to be used for turning the mills, but obviously extended from that. And we do see them trying to make use of this now, but I'm amazed that this could have been done 100 years ago, because they have tried doing this in a part of Wales and they actually gave up doing it. I'm not quite sure why. What do you know about this tidal energy that can be used here, Max?
I have to say, I don't know a tremendous amount about it. It all sounds highly plausible. I know that the Severn Bore, as it's called, is highly regarded as being a source of natural energy that's not properly been exploited so far, and that has existed, as we now understand, all the way back to the times of Blatchford and before. So I certainly think it's something that can be explored. And I think there are lots of ways in which we can exploit natural energy, the wind and the tides. I think that a lot of people, when they see these large windmills nowadays, they sort of decry the fact that they look hideous and they spoil the countryside. I don't think that's I don't find them that hideous. I find the windmills actually quite attractive shapes. They are naturally shaped in order to catch the wind as optimally as possible, and anything that's shaped by nature tends to be an attractive design, and I think that the wind power farms and things that have been set up off the coast of England will be able to produce a tremendous amount of electricity and can certainly help us in terms of cleaning up the planet and certainly cleaning up Britain. The only downside, I think, to having such a great reliance on natural power sources is that it makes the country more vulnerable to attack, because I think it would be very difficult to defend the windmills and the wind farms that exist off the coast of England. And so that's something that people perhaps need to think about. But other than that, I think that there is tremendous scope, and it is just a shame that people who were forward looking like Blatchford, who were thinking about these things over 100 years ago, that they weren't listened to by more people, because we could have been in a much better situation now than we are had Blatchford become a prime minister, for example.
It amazes me that all the environmental side of things has been hijacked by the left, because it's a nationalist occupation, isn't it? I mean, it's blood and soil. It's the soil that we're interested in, and it's the environment and preserving the environment, not just preserving our race and preserving our people and our culture, but preserving the landscape that we have shaped over thousands of years and not harming it. And I may not agree with you with the windmills. I don't like to see the windmills, because I like to see a beautiful natural landscape that doesn't look like that there's any industry there, and then you see these windmills on top of the hills, and it's like it's the government intruding on your space when you're trying to get away from them. I think maybe tidal power would be a better idea. It would be less intrusive. I should imagine that most of it would actually be under the water. It wouldn't have to be on top of it.
If you go somewhere where there are wooden windmills that date back 200 years or so, people always go, oh, look at that lovely windmill. You know, it's the fact that it's 200 years old that sort of dampens people's sort of reaction to it. And if people thought the same way of a modern shaped windmill, then that it could have exactly the same effect. People could say, oh, look at all these lovely windmills generating electricity very cleanly, and they're not really intruding that much on our enjoyment of the rest of the land. They might be featuring photographs where we might have liked it otherwise for them not to be there, but we wouldn't have objected had there been a whole row of old wooden windmills. So why object because they are taller and steel windmills?
Well, because they don't look so natural. And you think of the windmill, it's got a natural shape to it. It looks almost like a part of the body, almost like a sort of phallic shape there. And the actual wings of the windmill, they look rather like feathers with feathered wings. And when you look at the windmills, it just looks synthetic, and it doesn't look as if it's a natural part of the landscape. But the windmills do. I mean, even the smaller ones, they look like the old dovecots or like beehives, the old style of beehive, and they do have a much more natural feel to them. But they're probably not as economic, probably not as good at producing the power. But as I say, I think tidal power, from what he's saying there, I mean, that is a phenomenal amount of power that could be harnessed. Absolutely phenomenal. And it would be under the water. It is baffling to me how the left have managed to take this over, because it is such a nationalist preoccupation with the environment. Well, he continues, now, Mr. Smith, why should we make cotton goods for foreign countries? The Manchester School will tell you that we must do it to buy corn. In 1885, we exported cotton goods to the value of £66 million, and we imported corn and flour in the same year to the value of £53 million. Why? The Manchester School will tell you that we cannot grow our own corn, and that is not true. They will tell you that as foreigners can grow corn more cheaply than we can, and as we can make cotton goods more cheaply than they can, it is to the interest of both parties to exchange. I do not believe that any nation can sell corn more cheaply than we could produce it, and I am sure that even if it cost a little more to grow our corn than to buy it, yet it would be to our interest to grow it. I know it has been said, and it is said, that an English farmer owning his land cannot compete with foreign dealers. But I think that is doubtful, and I'm sure that if the land were owned by the state and farmed systematically by the best methods, we might grow our corn more cheaply than we could buy it. Now, I'll just stop there, because you have a sense of self-sufficiency when you're growing your own corn. You can take pride in the fact that you're producing this for yourself, and the people are out there in the fields and in the beautiful countryside, rather than being in the factory and working in the factory. It's going to be much better to be out in the environment, breathing in the fresh air. I mean, people who actually live in the fresh air and live in the country, they live for much longer than the people that live in the cities. And part of that has got to be because they're surrounded by beauty all the time. And he made this point earlier in the book as well, talking about the need to have beauty around you. So it's not just the fact that that they would be producing their own corn, but that it would also be conducive to them being outside, being in the fresh air, getting their hands into the soil, and just being surrounded by the beauty of the countryside. Do you think, Max?
Well, Blatchford, I think, was quite right in the statement he made that British corn growers could grow corn just as effectively and just as economically as foreign corn growers. But he was talking at that time about competition between British farmers and perhaps French farmers or German farmers or Italian farmers So he was talking about competition with farmers that lived in societies where there was a similar standard of living. And so in that respect, it certainly was the case that a British farmer could produce corn just as efficiently as another competitor European country could produce corn. But what he wasn't thinking about was the corn imported from faraway places where there was an entirely different level of mechanism, or where there was an entirely different level of standard of living in that country, because as far as the cotton trade is concerned, the cotton trade was lost to Britain because cotton could be produced more cheaply in India, largely because the Indian workers were prepared to work for only a fraction of what the British workers were prepared to work for, and so therefore our cotton industry was then exported to India. And there were companies whose objective was, over the last 100 years or so, to dismantle and take the machines that had been used to produce cotton in the cotton mills of Britain and take them over to India and reassemble them in factories in India where the cheaper labour could produce the cotton more cheaply than it could be produced here in Britain. So that's why the cotton industry was destroyed in the north of England. Same thing goes for leather goods. There are certain towns in England and Britain as a whole that were famous for producing leather goods. Northampton, a town that I used to live in, was famous for producing shoes. But I encountered people who were running companies that specialised in the dismantling and transporting of shoe manufacturing machinery from Northampton over to India, and they did nothing but that. That was their entire raison d'etre. They were dismantling an industry, transporting it and reassembling it somewhere else where people were prepared to work for less and could therefore produce shoes more cheaply than they were being produced in this country. I'm sure it didn't only happen in Britain. I'm sure it happened in Germany and France and other European countries, that they lost their industries to third world countries during the last 100 years or so. And so as far as Robert Blatchford is concerned, he wasn't quite right in the sense that the British farmer could stand up to competition from anywhere else in the world. But what he was right about was that we could stand up to competition from other European countries. And this is probably the main principle that provides the idea of the European Union, with some justification that the European Union tried to create a kind of closed economy where a priority would be given to goods produced within the European Union, albeit that the European Union suffered other mortal failings. But the point is that in this country, had we governments that had that would have supported the cotton industry and that would have applied taxes on cotton, cheaper cotton coming from India, for example, then the transportation and the loss of our cotton industry would have been stopped. The transportation and the loss of our leather goods industry would have been stopped. The woolen industry would have been saved, and there would still be lots of industry in the north of England providing jobs for lots of people that would have been cleaner and more productive, and that would have provided them with steady careers and a living throughout their lifetimes.
Yeah, who could have seen where free trade was going to end up? I mean, the same thing's happened in America, really, with all the industry being hived off to China and entire factories being boxed up and sent off to China. But continuing here, Blatchford says, well, suppose we could not. The logical result of the free trade argument would be that British agriculture must perish. And what do we lose? We lose the beauty and the health of our factory towns. We lose annually some 20,000 lives in Lancashire alone. We are in constant danger of great strikes, like that which recently so crushed our cotton operatives. We are reduced to the meanest shifts in the most violent acts of piracy and slaughter to open up markets for our goods. We lose the stamina of our people, and we lose our agriculture. Did you ever consider what it involves, this ruin of British agriculture? That's interesting, the way that he links all those things together, and also shows this awareness of the piracy and the slaughter, the bad side of the British Empire and how that was intended to open up these markets over there. I'm not so certain that the rest of the country were aware of that. What do you think of what he has to say here, Max?
I think he's quite right there. I mean, that the British Empire was, I believe, beneficial to the vast majority of people who became subject to it. But as with all things, it didn't come without a cost. And part of the cost and part of the downside of having the British Empire was the fact that there was a certain amount of conflict between ourselves and other countries where we were trying to, where plutocrats within our society, people who were globalist in their economic aims and who were able to shift money from country to country and who were aiming to benefit from having the cheapest labour, were able to use our navy and our army in order to subdue competitors and in order to provide them with riches at the expense of the lives of the rest of our people.
And we lost a lot of our agriculture anyway. We probably have less people that are dying now. I mean, you said some 20,000 lives in Lancashire alone that end up being lost. Was that in industrial accidents through illness, or what is he referring to there? I mean, that seems an awful lot of people's lives to lose annually. Or is that just early death? What is he referring to there? Do you know?
I think a lot of early industry was quite dangerous, and you could quite easily, if you weren't didn't have your wits about you, and you were operating a machine in a factory, you could quite easily lose a finger or lose your hand if you didn't sort of pull it back fast enough as the some kind of a shuttle or something was zinging past you. And there were lots of machines that operated without adequate guards in early times, and so people tended to get injured on those. And because the factories were, you know, quite dirty places to work, and I think I mentioned to you last week about how you know just nicking your finger working in some of the dirty factories that existed in Britain over the last 100 years or so could end up produce a really severe infection for you if you weren't careful. There was a higher mortality rate. And it's the mortality rate in this country has been improved as a result of there being better medical facilities, as a result of people eating a more balanced diet, and as a result of the National Health Service providing people with medical care that previous generations didn't have. But a lot of the improvements have also come as a result of the introduction of safety at work practices and things of this sort, where organisations have gone round to make sure that factories do have the guardrails and things fitted to their machines so that people can't fall in or catch themselves in. You still hear occasionally, and it was perhaps more common in the past, where women particularly who didn't have their hair tied up in a bun, if they had long hair and it perhaps hung down to their waist, as it does if you let it grow naturally, lots of women that worked in industry would catch their hair in a machine and then be dragged into the machine by their hair and have their scalp ripped off in order to save their lives, and who were then sort of grossly disfigured, but would then very often get an infection as a result of the gaping wound on the top of their head, etc. And so factories were dangerous places to work, and particularly the cotton jennies, I think they were called, the machinery that was used to weave cotton and to weave other fabrics. The children used to be employed to scrabble around on the floor underneath the machinery, picking up bits that fell off, and sometimes rejoining pieces of thread that had snapped whilst the machines were still working very often. And the children in those circumstances, you know, quite often used to lose fingers and hands.
makes you really pleased that you're alive today, really. I mean, we complain about conditions today, but they were far worse 100 years ago, and it completely destroys this myth of white privilege. I mean, that was how most people had to live. You know, they had to work 12, 16 hours a day just to bring home a pittance. They didn't have the spare time that we have now, and these are all the things that Blatchford was campaigning to put a stop to and to improve. Let's talk some more about Robert Blatchford, the social nationalist, the British social nationalist. And we'll be quoting again from Merry England, his book. Last week we talked about British agriculture, and this week we will be looking at autarky. And again, we will be quoting from Blatchford's book, Merry England. So, from page 34, he says, "Now, suppose we get at last to a state of things under which 36 million live on foreign-grown wheat and none on wheat of home growth. Suppose our agriculture is dead and we depend entirely upon foreigners for our daily bread. What will be our position then? Our position will be this. We shall be unable to produce our own food and can only get it by selling to foreign countries our manufactured goods. We must buy wheat from America with cotton goods. But first of all, we must buy raw cotton with which to make those goods. We are therefore entirely dependent upon foreigners for our existence. Very well, suppose we go to war with America. What happens? Do you remember the cotton famine? That was bad, but a mere trifle to what an Anglo-American war would be. We should, in fact, be beaten without firing a shot. America need only close her ports to corn and cotton, and we should be starved into surrender and acceptance of her terms. Or suppose a European war, say, with France or Russia. All our goods and all our food have to be brought overseas. What would it cost us to keep command of the seas? What would the effect of the panic be here? And suppose we found our communications cut. We should be starved into surrender at once. Or suppose France at war with America. Our sufferings would be something terrible. Don't you see that if we destroy our agriculture, we destroy our independence at a blow and become a defenceless nation?" Now, I find this interesting because obviously we have our special relationship with America now. I very much doubt whether we would ever go to war with America. But back then, 100 years ago, we didn't actually have that relationship. And there was a fear that we could end up going to war with America. I don't think we could end up going to war with France, but there is concern about going to war with Russia. And still, a lot of our food comes from abroad. We're still not actually producing it for ourselves. And back then, we were still making cotton goods. I mean, today, we're mainly involved in financial instruments, or at least that's what they tell us, is that the City of London is essential for global trade because of the financial instruments. But I really can't think of much that we actually make in Britain now that we export to the rest of the world. And really, we should be making the very best of whatever it is that we need within the country, and certainly growing our own food for ourselves. What do you make of what he has to say here, Max?
Well, I think this is something that we went into last week in some detail, really, which and I think the same can be said of the last few remarks that you've read out about him, that he's absolutely correct. Autarky, which is having self-sufficiency in terms of all vital goods and services, autarky is something that every nation should strive for, because it gives that nation its independence. If you are dependent upon the other nations around you, then you don't have independence, you have interdependence. And interdependence means that you can't act independently, you can't act individually. You've got to always move with the group. For any nation to function properly as an independent nation, you need to have autarky. I think I said last time we discussed this, Blatchford went to sort of great lengths to demonstrate that it would be possible for England to feed herself. I think is the way he described it there. I think it probably was more a matter of Britain and the British Isles in those days, because Southern Ireland would have still been part of the British Isles and part of Britain. up to that point, but it was possible for, he'd calculated together with an aristocrat that the British Isles could support 200 million people. And I think that, as I said last time as well, I've checked those figures out using just purely potatoes, and obviously nobody wants to eat a diet of just purely potatoes, but if we just ate potatoes, then we could produce enough potatoes, even in Britain in its diminished size, having lost Southern Ireland, we could still produce enough potatoes to feed the entire nation. And so the possibility of autarky still presents itself, and if we were to pursue a policy of autarky, it would put us in such a so much stronger position, because all of the issues that we have with the European Union at the moment about trade between our crossing our borders, all of those issues would be massively diminished in their severity and their importance if we were able to feed ourselves, and if we were able to produce enough white goods to service our the domestic demand, if we're able to produce enough cars to service domestic demand for cars, etc. So autarky in all things is a good thing, and Blatchford was absolutely right.
It has produced a great boost to the economy in Russia and in China, where there's been sanctions against them. They've had to produce all their own goods. But what do you have to say about the argument that interdependence prevents wars between the countries that are interdependent? Because this is the argument that was used for forming the EU, is that if we have everybody joined up, and if the trade is all joined up and everybody is relying on everybody else, then there won't be any wars. And you have to admit, there hasn't been any wars since the war against Germany, apart from this war against Serbia, but Serbia was outside of the EU. So what would you say to that argument, Max, that the interdependence does actually prevent wars?
The interdependence will, to some extent, prevent wars from being able to be waged as easily. I don't know that it would necessarily stop wars altogether. I think that I'm just trying to think back at the struggles that there have been within the European Union. You've got to look, I suppose, at the situation in Northern Ireland, the troubles that existed there. Struggle against the IRA, in my view, was a low-level war. It wasn't actually just criminality on the part of various criminal individuals. It was a war between those people in Northern Ireland who wanted a republican, who wanted Northern Ireland to be absorbed into a free Ireland covering the entire island of Ireland, and so there was a war on that basis. I think it's fairly logical that if you have interdependence, it is going to create some barriers to wars, but it also creates barriers to towards any or all sorts of other things. And if you have a situation where because interdependence means also that you've got to have regulations imposed on all of the groups that are imposed by the majority upon the entire population of an entity like the European Union, as soon as there is sufficient polarization for one group one way or the other to be prepared to use force, then a war would occur, and the war would either be a war where the European Union used its might, and the fact that it is developing intends to develop a European army, uses that European army to crush a rebellion in a rebellious part of the European Union, or a war in the sense that the people within that rebellious part of the European Union take a leaf out of the IRA's book decide to fight a guerrilla war against the empire.
Yeah, so there is some argument for interdependence, but you would still be at risk anyway. I mean, it's really a fool's argument, isn't it, to just not produce all your own goods because you can get it from these other groups, and then there'll be less chance of war, because it just puts you at risk of then being taken over by by the banks, really, by the majority, as you pointed out there, with the European Union, and the majority ended up making laws for the minority, and you really not having much say about it. I mean, it's a way to stealthily take over a country, isn't it, to get them to be all interdependent with these other countries. Well, continuing,
it builds up resentment on the part of the minority that are having the views of the majority imposed upon them, and to their detriment, as they would see it.
Yeah, I think that's what we see happening in Hungary, isn't it? Hungary yes. is not happy about that. Well, continuing from page 35, don't you see that the people who depend on foreigners for their food are at the mercy of any ambitious statesman who chooses to make war upon them? And don't you think that it is a rather stiff price to pay to get a farthing off of the loaf? Well, Mr. Smith, thanks to the Manchester School, to the factory system, and to the grasping landlord who is generally a Tory and fond of barging about the security of the empire, we are almost helpless now. Another 20 years of prosperous trade and cheap bread, and we are done for. Again, how shall we look if, after we have killed our agriculture, we lose our trade? Do you think that impossible? Your cotton lords seem to think it possible enough, and are now telling you that the only means of keeping the trade, which is to kill your agriculture, lose your national independence, and to lower your wages. That farthing off the loaf is going to cost you dear, John Smith, before you have done with it. And I think here he's pointing out that if you depend on these foreigners, you'll be at the mercy of any ambitious statesman, but really we've been at the mercy of the ambitious bankers, which he hasn't really mentioned here. Does he mention the bankers at all in the book, do you know, Max? And what are your thoughts on this?
He does mention bankers. I don't know that necessarily we should think too much in terms of bankers, more in terms of as far as foreign trade is concerned. Foreign trade eventually results in a race to the bottom in terms of wages, because if workers at home are having to compete with workers around the other side of the world who have a much lower standard of living and who are prepared to work for a fraction of what is needed in order to make a living in this country, then what will happen is that goods produced around the other side of the world will be imported because they'll be cheaper, and that will then put our homegrown industries out of business, or it will force our workers to work for the same wages that people are able to survive on around the other side of the world. And we see that happening to a certain extent with various globalist countries saying that there is a need, or politicians that support and that are mouthpieces for globalist companies. We see them saying that it's necessary for us to become competitive with the rest of the world. And what that means is that we effectively have to find some magic way of making more with less, or we have to accept a lower standard of living. And so from that point of view, in terms of the welfare of the majority of people, it places that welfare at odds with the welfare of the globalist trader, because the globalist trader obviously is going to buy from the parts of the world that have got the lowest prices, the people that work there. And so, as I say, international trade therefore creates a race to the bottom. And that's why, as far as British industry is concerned, when we were a far more nationalist country, when we relied far more on homegrown produce, we built up an empire and we were a very powerful nation within the world. But once we stopped doing that, what's happened is that we've become economically weaker and weaker. Our industries have been exported abroad. We're importing more from abroad than we've ever done before. As far as the majority of people in this country are concerned, we haven't really had a real terms pay rise for probably 30 years. And so what we're seeing is a process whereby the living standard in this country has topped out and is slowly in decline because of competition from cheap labour abroad, or competition from cheap labour that is imported into this country or allowed to migrate into this country from abroad.
if you look at the countries that actually have autarky, if you look at China and you look at Russia, I mean, their economies are booming, their wages are going up, their life expectancy is going up, you know, that they're having a whale of a time. And they're attacked by the World Banks and by NATO and the rest of it for having nationalist policies, basically, particularly in China, where they invest in the private companies and they get told, well, this is unfair business practices. You're not supposed to help your own country out. Well, why not? And it's the same with Russia, where Russia has been put under all these sanctions. Russia ends up now producing all its own goods for itself. And again, their wages keep increasing. Their quality of life keeps on increasing. I mean, it really does shame this Western capitalist system when you look at Russia and China and how well they are doing. And it is down to autarky. It's down to taking pride in the fact that you produce everything that you need for yourself. I mean, who is going to be best at doing that? Well, obviously, you are going to be best at doing that. And that is the way that we used to be. And that is what led to us having an empire. And it's losing that. And that has led to us losing the empire, basically. Continuing with these quotes here, he says, "Your trade unions tell you that you have beaten all foreign competition except that of India. Do you think that you can fight India, John? I don't. Because in India, labour is so cheap. And because your cotton lords, John, some of whom are liberals and friends of the people, John, and others of whom are Tories, who would die for the safety of the empire, John, who will take precious good care to use that cheap Indian labour to bring down your wages, John, by means of competition. Oh, John, John, you silly fellow, have you no eyes? These are some of the reasons why I don't love the factory system. Consider them and read the history of that system and how its first successes were bought by the murder and torture of little children and spent in buying the freedom of West Indian slaves and in waging war against the French Republic. The thing is evil. It is evil in its origin, in its progress, in its methods, in its motives, and in its effects. No nation can be sound whose motive power is greed. No nation can be secure unless it is independent. No nation can be independent unless it is based upon agriculture." So I think it's great there that we see that the green agenda that is tied in with the nationalist agenda, that is tied in with the socialist agenda. And yes. You're thinking he's a socialist, and yet he's pointing out at that time there that we should have been concentrating on our own people, not buying the freedom of West Indian slaves. I mean, that's very interesting for me to see that somebody who is a socialist is pointing that out, that, you know, that we should have been looking at what was going on here. And do you know who he's talking about here with the murder and torture of little children? And why did he think it was wrong to wage war against the French Republic? Do you know?
I can't really think off the top of my head about the last question about the French Republic. A lot of the taxes that were a lot of taxes were raised so that the government could buy out the right of again globalist traders and people who owned plantations in the Americas to buy out their right to own slaves, which is something that, you know, Black Lives Matter have been complaining about. But, you know, basically what's happened in the intervening period is that the British taxpayer has paid for the money that was given to those slave owners. And so, you know, we've actually done our bit as far as providing those people with their freedom. The murder and torture of little children basically just refers to, I think, the iniquitous working conditions that existed in factories. And I think last time I sort of described the way in which the factory machinery didn't have safety guards and things of that sort fitted in those days. And so little children were very often required to crawl around under machines, lubricating them, and in the case of the textiles industry, where the weft of the cotton, or whatever it's called, the strand of cotton where it snapped, or wool where it snapped, then had to be joined back together again. Very often children would have been employed to tie the knots in those pieces of string while the machinery was still operating. And so they had these very fast moving parts to these machines, and quite often little children would lose a finger or two in doing that kind of work. And so it was very long hours that they had to work for very little pay, and it was very dangerous for them to work under those conditions, not just because of the fear of being injured, but also from the fact that the atmosphere in those textile mills would have been laden with cotton dust and with particles of cut strands of wool, etc., which would have been inhaled into their lungs. And I think a lot of children, a lot of people developed lung diseases as a result of working under those conditions.
Well, he's also can see far ahead here to what was going to happen with India. I mean, we looked at India and we thought, well, this is good. There'll be a trading partner. They will buy the things that we can make within Britain. But he could see that in India, labour is so much cheaper. And eventually, all that we're producing here in Britain, is all the machinery is going to be shipped off over to India, and they'll be making it in India because they'll be able to do that cheaper. And he's pointing out that there's no loyalty here to the people, from the cotton lords, from the Tories to the Liberals. None of them have actually got any loyalty to the British people. They're just thinking about where they can get the labour the cheapest, and obviously it's going to be from India, and that is what happened. So he could see that's what was going on. And I mean, he wrote this book around about 1900, and it didn't happen for quite some time after that, but eventually it did. I mean, he was so right in what he was pointing out here, and it's such a shame that today the green agenda has been hijacked by the communists and the socialist ideas, which are basically just nationalist ideas. They've been hijacked by the communists, and the nationalists don't often talk about these things so much, because I mean, when you think about it, the green agenda, it's blood and soil, isn't it? It's all about the soil. We were the ones that were first concerned about the damage that was being done to our country. If you look at Patriotic Alternative today, most of what they do is out in the countryside, getting people out in the countryside, going on hikes, litter picking, appreciating the beauty of the country that we live in. It's not just all about race. It's about the land that we live in and the way that it's been shaped by our forefathers. And the only people that are truly going to appreciate that are the children of our forefathers, the children of the people that shape the land, that are going to continue to shape it. And yet this is now been hijacked, and you have the Green Party, which is basically just a front for communism. Do you know whether the left actually look to Blatchford as a hero of the left, or do they sort of try to forget about him and his nationalist leanings, Max? Do you know anything about that?
I think they try to forget about him, to be quite honest. What Blatchford predicted with regard to India not only happened with India, but it's also, since World War II, happened with Japan as well. You see, Japan was a country that had been developing machinery, etc., and going through an industrial revolution, which is what then enabled the Japanese to wage war. But the point is that at the end of the Second World War, if you compared Japan to Germany, Germany had been absolutely bombed flat. So their industry was temporarily out of action. Whereas as far as Japan is concerned, they'd had two nuclear weapons drops on them, but all the rest of their society, all the rest of their country was still intact. And yet it was then taken over by primarily by the Americans, but notionally by the Allies. But it then created a massive market where the country was going through a kind of a political revolution, and it made it easy then for multinational firms from America to move into Japan and to take advantage of the fact that they'd got a skilled workforce, the fact that they had industrialized, and they then started to produce cars and motorcycles much more cheaply than they could be produced in America. And so therefore, if you look at Detroit and the large car manufacturing plants and things that existed in that belt of America, together with Harley Davidson, who were producing very large numbers of motorcycles, what's then happened was that they were competing against Japanese workers who, because they'd lost the war and who therefore had very much diminished circumstances, were prepared to work for much lower wages than the American workers had become used to working for. And but because they were skilled people who had industrialized, they were very quickly able to produce a mass, create a mass market for Japanese produced motorcycles initially in the United States and also in Europe, but also then a mass market for Japanese produced cars. And now we see that Detroit is at just a shadow of its former self, and large swathes of the American car industry have just been wiped out by Japan. And then once the Japanese had increased their standard of living so that they their standard of living has risen now to rival the standard of living in countries in the West. So we've then had China following suit, and China being the provider of cheap labor, who have then taken a lot of work away from Japan. And if you go online and you look at very cheaply produced cars, and particularly at the moment, very cheaply produced motorcycles, and other electrical goods, iPhones and things of that sort, the Chinese are the ones that are making them, because the Chinese have started off from a much lower level where wages were much lower. So they've just purely on the basis of wages, they've been able to undercut the industries that had previously existed in America and in Europe, but then transferred to Japan. And so the Chinese have undercut the Japanese. And now we've got the little tiger republics of Southeast Asia, also now then producing goods in an attempt to undercut the Chinese. And so it's this continual process of undercutting that is the consequence of global capitalism, and which creates a kind of moving feast of, well, not a moving feast, but a moving famine of political and economic uncertainty that just rolls around the world as one country faces economic deprivation as a result of being undercut by another, and then in turn undercuts another part of the world, and so on. So it is a sad situation and a sad system that needs to be replaced.
It strikes me that one thing that covers this up, because people think, well, we're getting cheaper and cheaper goods. Look how cheap the goods are that's coming from China. So okay, things might go down a little bit in price. But what about inflation? You know, we've had masses of inflation. All the while that things get cheaper, they might seem to be a little bit cheaper to buy, but everything gradually goes up, doesn't it? Because we always have inflation all the time. If you look at the prices that things used to be in the 60s, I mean, they're 10 times the price now. But if you were to go back 150 years, you would find that the prices were stable for going back hundreds of years before that. They were the same price. If you look at ancient history, everything was the same price right throughout the ancient civilizations of the Near East. And then you come to the 20th century, and suddenly, after the Second World War, you get this inflation all the time that's happening. So it's an illusion. You've got an illusion that things are actually getting cheaper while they're being you're able to make them cheaper abroad. But everything gradually goes up in price. I'm correct in thinking that, aren't I, Max?
Yes, everything does go up in price as a result of that, because even within the countries where they start off with a very low standard of living, and so therefore are able to undercut their competitors on the basis of their low wages, then as a result of undercutting their competitors, they then gradually become wealthier themselves, and therefore they then start to pay themselves more money. And they then fall victim to the same thing themselves. But the thing really which is driving inflation, firstly, there's some inflation which is caused as a result of manipulations within the banking system within the world. But also inflation is being caused by virtue of the fact that we have unrestricted and unrestrained population growth across the world. And that is then feeding demand for the limited resources that exist across the globe, and that is driving prices up.
So you might get cheaper electronic gadgets from China, but the actual value of the money that you have in your hand, it's continually losing its value while you've got this illusion, while you've got this illusion of these cheap gadgets. Thank you very much for listening, and do watch out for episode 4 in this series on Greatest Britain, Robert Blatchford.